This is Terrence McNally. This week, you'll hear my conversation with Ed Hughes about his book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. We spoke in June 2011.
I've done a few interviews over the years about Walmart, probably all of them questioning, if not outright negative, its relentless, even ruthless pursuit of everyday low prices, combined with its enormous size and volume, led inevitably to a race to a global bottom in the many aspects of retail, sweatshops and near slave labor in overseas production, unlivable wages, lack of benefits and union busting among U.S. workers, the elimination of local competition, and pollution, waste, and greenhouse gases in production and transportation. So when I've heard over the last few years of Walmart's conversion to sustainability, I've been hopeful. A corporation big enough to influence the behavior of its supply chain, as well as its competitors, can make a huge difference that makes a difference. I've also been skeptical for a couple of reasons. First, so many corporations spend more money promoting their green good works than they do putting them into action. Would Walmart make sustainability a core principle or merely a media-friendly add-on? Second, even if the company had finally realized that waste hurts the bottom line as much as the environment, would they still cut corners everywhere else? Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ed Hughes has a new book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution, that starts with the same sort of skepticism, asks some of the same questions, and ends up delivering a lot of good news. Walmart has embraced an unprecedented green makeover, which is now spreading worldwide. The retail giant is leveraging the power of 200 million weekly customers to drive waste, toxics, and carbon emissions out of its stores and products. Neither an act of charity nor an empty greenwash, its green move reflects a simple, compelling philosophy that the most sustainable, clean, energy-efficient, and waste-free company will beat its competitors every time, not just in some distant utopian future, but today. From energy conservation, recycling, hybrid trucks, to reduced packaging and partnerships with environmentalists it once met only in court, Walmart has used sustainability to boost its bottom line even in a tough economy, belying the age-old claim that going green kills jobs and profits. Now, the global apparel business, the American dairy industry, big agriculture, and even Wall Street are following Walmart's lead, along with the 100,000 manufacturers whose products must become more sustainable to remain on Walmart shelves. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Edward Hughes has received the Pulitzer Prize for his journalism and numerous awards for his books. He's written for the New York Times, the LA Times, Sunday Magazine, Esquire, Los Angeles Magazine. His books include Monkey Girl, Over Here, School of Dreams, Baby ER, Mean Justice, No Matter How Loud I Shout, the bestseller Mississippi Mud, and his newest, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. Welcome, Edward Hughes, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Thanks, Terrence. It's great to be in here.
Good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So tell us just a little bit about your path to the work you're doing today.
Well, began with newspapers. I was a newspaper reporter at the start of my writing career. And actually, before I was professional, I did it in college as a stringer, helped put myself through school. And always have been drawn to multi-dimensional stories that are just kind of interesting people stories that capture attention and interest, but also have a higher social purpose to telling that story, not just for entertainment. But so, you know, from juvenile court, I've done a lot of work writing about that and other aspects of the justice system, education, things that really are the issues that and institutions that people – that are a big part of people's lives. And, of course, the environment, if you're a journalist, there's no bigger story right now than what's going on there. So It was natural to gravitate towards that subject for my last couple books.
Okay. And before we talk in depth about the Walmart story, I want to talk a little about your previous book, Echo Barons. But before I do, was my intro fairly accurate?
Yeah, it was an excellent summary of the book.
Okay.
You're doing it better than I do, so I appreciate it.
Okay. So let's talk, as I said, a little bit about Echo Barons, the dreamers, schemers, and millionaires who are saving our planet. Because I know, one reason I'm doing this is I know that Force of Nature grew out of that book. So what was that book? How did that book happen?
Well, this was... the concept was to tell a series of interrelated stories about environmental outliers, essentially activists, philanthropists, people who were ahead of the rest of the world in terms of their vision. And it was a interesting selection of people. The first character you meet is Doug Tompkins, who was the founder and CEO of Esprit, you know, the fashion powerhouse company of the 70s and 80s. He made $1 billion, sold his company. And moved to Patagonia and started buying land in Chile and Argentina.
Not the company, but
the place. And over time, he and his wife, who actually is the former CEO of the Patagonia company, have preserved more rainforest than any individuals on the planet. And what they do is they buy up this land, which particularly in Chile, they were very happy to see that kind of investment until they realized, wait, you're not cutting down trees and building things. You just want to keep it like it is forever. And then they wonder what the heck this guy was up to. But he has managed to donate immense tracts of irreplaceable landscapes and habitat to nonprofits that are controlled by the Chileans and Argentinians, or directly as national parks to the government, so that these important landscapes will be preserved. Over 1 million acres, which is pretty
substantial. 1 million acres. You're talking real land, yeah.
And he lives there with his wife, and they live and breathe this deep ecology vision that he has embraced. So he goes from uber capitalist but also a mountain climber, outdoorsman kind of guy to preserving landscapes and giving money to other groups and individuals who are engaged in similar work, which is how the story progresses, because the next part of the tale is the Center for Biological Diversity, which he helped support and has done more to enforce the Endangered Species Act and has been more effective at protecting important habitats than any other organization on the planet.
Say the name of that organization again, because my guess is when people think environmental groups or conservation groups, there's about 3 or 4 names that probably come to mind who do play a role. Almost all of them play some role in Force of Nature. But this one is one that people I don't think have heard of.
You haven't, probably, the Center for Biological Diversity, but you are familiar with their work because they've been engaged in all the big causes for protecting endangered species. For instance, they were the lead force in compelling the Bush administration to, A, admit that global warming was happening, human-caused global warming, and that the polar bear had to be protected as an endangered species, something that the government was resisting. They have like a 90% win rate when they take on a case, which is, you know, any law firm doing any kind of litigation would love to have. So they are just a very effective group, and they're lean and mean, and they kind of aren't afraid to be mean.
Right. And I saw that Terry Tamminen, our former California Secretary of EPA and a guest on this show within the next 6 weeks or so, I'm interviewing him about his new book, Cracking the Carbon Code, is one of your Echo Barons.
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, he got to start as a pool cleaner in Malibu, hooks up with Arnold when he's decides
to run
for
governor. Let's give him the middle part he cleaned Arnold's pool and Arnold said, come to Sacramento.
No, he did.
He did become the Santa Monica
Riverkeeper.
The baykeeper of Santa Monica Bay, and then ran the whole coastal waterkeeper group for a while.
Yes. He's got a very funny story about someone he did clean pools for, Dustin Hoffman, saying, "Hey, glad to see you're keeping the big pool clean now." And but it was that work and his the fact that it put him together with Bobby Kennedy Jr. that led to the connection to Schwarzenegger, and who he agreed to help him craft an environmental policy. And he's the reason why Schwarzenegger's environmental policies and record is what it is. I mean, it's so startlingly progressive.
And will end up being the positive legacy of his governorship.
Yeah, unless it gets torn down, which some people would like to do.
I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize winner Ed Humes about his new book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. And to learn more, you can go to Edward Humes, Edward, and then H-U-M-E-S, one word, edwardhumes.com. So let's move then from how did the Echo Baron story lead you to Force of Nature?
Well, while I was doing research for Echo Barons, I was introduced to a fellow named Jib Ellison.
That's Jib, J-I-B.
Jib, J-I-B.
Yeah.
And he is a river guide, among other things, and a whitewater rafting specialist, and spent the first part of his adulthood and before that even doing one of these incredible global river journeys. He's like Paddler of the Century, according to Paddler magazine.
Right.
Which is, the Bible of that. That endeavor, and coincidentally, he used to work for Doug Tompkins, the Patagonia preserver, and knew a number of the people that I was interviewing, and they kept telling me, "You got to talk to this guy, Jib." So I did, and he.
Oh, and also, take us back. How long ago is this that you're being told talk to Jib? Is this 5, 6 years ago?
More like 3, 4 years ago, and. He told me about this nonprofit he had founded, Project Raft. He was bringing, during the Cold War, Soviets and Americans together on these wild river trips in Siberia and then in the States. And I got quite a bit of attention as a very effective citizen diplomacy kind of effort during a time when the things were defrosting in the Cold War. So
right.
it was part of that opening up.
You sit together in a raft or next to someone in another raft and you're going down whitewater and
– Yeah, hair-raising.
You're both human beings.
You're literally pulling together through treacherous waters. And in Jib's mind, it's the perfect metaphor for those times and for these times indeed. And there's this magical bond that occurs in these kinds of environments that was very effective in bringing opposites together and finding out, well, we're not so opposite after all. And this would play a role in his later life, too, the same kind of approach. But he had gone from this nonprofit world into the world of business consulting. And he at first he worked with several partners in this firm in San Francisco working on corporate leadership. And there was no particular philosophy other than, he had skills, leading expeditions,
right.
How to communicate with diverse kinds of people. And he, that expertise was valuable to companies. But he wanted to bring back the nature and environmental aspect of his work and proposed to his partners. This is 2004 now. Let's make sustainability the center of our business practice. It's a great untapped opportunity. And in 2004, it was a largely untapped opportunity. And the partner said, look, we're making money. We're doing great. Why are we going to shake things up that way? That's not what our clients want. And there was big clients, Nokia and Home Depot, major companies that they were working with. And he said, well, I think there's a real opportunity here. I'm going to give it a try. So he leaves the company and goes out alone and wrangles a meeting through his connections with the CEO of Walmart, who then was H. Lee Scott, and was desperately looking for something good for the company to do that would try to overcome its very negative reputation.
Right. And this, to place it in time context, that's a voice of Ed Humes, by the way, and we're talking about his book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. That's before Katrina.
Yes.
And so it's the height of negative responses to, let's say, Walmart's negative behavior.
All the things you mentioned there, labor practices, gender issues, beginning to see complaints about the environmental footprint of its operations in the country, the sweatshop scandals, all that had added up to this perception of an evil empire, basically. And their internal studies, very alarming if you're a Walmart, showed that as many as 8% of their regular customers were going to walk away from them because of their sagging reputation and because of the perception that they were just bad.
Yeah. And
that's a big deal for
exactly.
Walmart.
When you operate on the margins they do.
Well, 8% is the difference between a great year and a disastrous year for them. And so they could not just stand by. And they were looking, what can we do to improve our reputation? So that was the start of it. It wasn't a noble cause to become more environmentally friendly. It was we need to be proactive.
So I'll take a crazy meeting with this guy.
With the river guy.
Yeah.
And he gives him his pitch, which is boils down to, look, all these things that a CEO normally thinks about when they hear the word environment, which is risk and cost and burden and regulation, throw that out the window. This is your biggest untapped opportunity of the 21st century, because all this stuff you think about as waste is just money on the ground waiting for you to pick it up. And they finished the conversation, and in essence, Lee Scott said, all right, prove it. Show me. And they set about turning Walmart into a laboratory to test this business case for sustainability.
This isn't the fantastic story where he wins him over with that conversation, but he gets the chance to prove it and goes after some low-hanging fruit.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, that was the plan. All right, let's prove it in the most graphic way possible and the easiest way possible. And Jeb was very confident that those kinds of opportunities were waiting. And sure enough, they were the kinds of return on investment that makes sense to Walmart.
The toy packaging.
Well, one of the early things they did was a toy truck. And, you know, you could say any product you name at Walmart, they sell by the millions. So right away, even small things become big because it's magnified by the scale. And in this case, they looked at this toy truck. It's made in China. It's plastic. It's for toddlers, preschoolers. And it came, of course, in a cardboard box, which is part of the marketing and part of the display. And they liked that box. It worked. It was effective. It did everything they wanted to do. But now they had to ask a new question about it. Can this package be more sustainable? Can we do something about its environmental footprint? So once you start asking that question, and you look at it, you say, well, we could make the package smaller. It's, you know, X percent bigger than the actual toy. What if we shave a few inches off of it? So they do. And the first thing they do is they learn 4,000 trees don't have to be cut down to supply the cardboard that
per year,
no longer is
right?
needed. Yes.
4,000 trees per year just for the cardboard they're eliminating. But that
exactly.
isn't even the big part.
Well, that, you know, that's nice for the environment. What does it do for us? Well, what it does for them is just under 500 fewer cargo containers have to be shipped from abroad.
Now, this isn't cases. This is cargo containers.
Big honking things at the port of Los Angeles.
You see on the port that then get shifted onto the backs of big rigs and
so on. Yes, so many hundreds of those don't need to drive.
So 500 less.
Right, 500 less.
Okay.
And a comparable fewer shipments by truck to stores have to occur because it's more package, you fit more on the truck. Duh. And the bottom line is Walmart saves $2.5 million by changing that package in one product. And if you think Walmart's too big to care about that, they'd have to sell $60 million worth of those toys to earn that same amount in profits, to net it.
Right. So that's one number that really jumped out at me. In other words, if you operate on small margins and big volume, then the amount of sales it would take to offset this savings is enormous. As you say, 60 million
– 60, 6-0.
More toys.
Right. So it's that's
which is means you got to find 60 million more customers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes.
So suddenly sustainability ain't so bad in Walmart's mind. And the first thing they start asking themselves, which is, of course, is what their new consultant slash river guy wants them to ask, is why didn't we see this before? It's so obvious now. And where else can we find these kinds of opportunities? Now they were, you know, it wasn't how can we save the planet so much as how can we do these things that are good for the planet and good for our business. And once you have a company with millions of employees told to start looking for these opportunities, they turn out to be everywhere.
And especially when you give them that demonstration. Because
exactly.
That demonstration is so simple. Another one you talk about that was another early one was laundry detergent.
That was one of their big ones. I mean, they changed that industry. The reason why small detergent bottles are now the standard and what most people buy now rather than those big honking gas can size things isn't because consumers were demanding it. They wanted the bigger one because we all know bigger is better, right? It's because Walmart said that's what we want. Unilever had tried to introduce these years before and couldn't get any traction on it because people just assumed that what is really just more plastic and more water to dilute detergent was somehow better because
right.
It looked bigger. You look
so
like you're getting more.
What they do is now it's a small bottle of concentrate, which
right.
used to be a large bottle of concentrate and water. And the savings on this one are even much bigger. One, you sell a lot more laundry detergent than toy trucks. Two, the packaging reduction is enormous.
Huge.
And
it's a billion bottle a year industry.
Okay.
And Walmart sells a quarter of that. So
okay.
If they say do that, it does it for everybody, not just what Walmart sells.
That's the other thing that, as I pointed out a little bit in the introduction, is when Walmart wants a change, the vendors change. The industry changes. A country will change its policies to accommodate Walmart. Let me tell people again, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize winner Ed Humes about his new book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. You can learn more at Edward Humes. That's Edward H-U-M-E-S, edwardhumes.com. So a couple of, as they early wins –
their trucks are another big
the trucks. Okay.
They have the second largest fleet of trucks. It's like 7,000 trucks and big rigs. They work with the Rocky Mountain Institute, and they
Amory Lovins, who's been a guest on the show a few times.
And he had done this kind of thing with the Defense Department. You know, he had all this is some organization that Jeb Ellison brought in. They brought in all kinds of other consultants, which was a big deal for the very insular Walmart. We can talk about that later. But they were looking at the trucks. How can we make these trucks do the same amount of work, but work less, use less energy? One of the things they did was install auxiliary power units, basically little
gas-powered generators.
But what they do is keep some of the systems of the running in the truck without the main engine being on and sitting there idling, which we've all seen those big rigs just with when they're parked and the driver's sleeping in there, but he needs the air conditioner or the heat or whatever. By doing that, it was like taking 700 of these big rigs off the road in terms of emission
out
and
of their 7,000. So it's like reducing
like a 10% reduction in fuel and emissions. Which is huge.
Again, when you say the question, you know, why didn't we see this sooner? We've had these trucks idling because everybody's always let their trucks idle. You go buy a supermarket, usually even today, and you'll see them. By the way, I was talking to someone about the port recently, and the port's doing a similar thing.
Yeah.
Where the boats, the ships, what am I saying?
Are
boats.
Plugging in, right?
Yeah. The ships used to idle their entire ship, so you're powering the entire ship while you're unloading. Now they plug in to generation.
Oh, and that's huge because the environment around that port is just one of the worst.
Well, as the environment around department stores, grocers, super centers
absolutely.
Like Walmart's, is the health around those is mostly bad from the diesel, which comes out of those trucks that are idling. So that was a huge one, and another, as we see, it's like, duh, why didn't we see it? Talk a little bit, if you will, about why didn't they see it?
Well, I do think it's the perception in the business world has traditionally been that environmental concerns are, first of all, not our core business. Second of all, big pain in the neck. It was all about compliance. It was, and also, you know, and that's the thing, the really important regulations and legislation that have protected species and habitat and water and air and are vital to, you know, what we've been able to hold on to. From the business person's corporation like Walmart's perspective, just another thing we have to, you know, comply with and get to satisfy the bare minimum and be done with it. So that's, you know, obviously not a strategy that encourages corporations
to innovate or to get out ahead of
To invest in a lot of the effort of their top echelon people.
But you're saying, I mean, what's interesting about this story, and I think it's maybe even one of the real kernels of this book, is that because of the way they perceived the environment, because of the way they perceived regulation, they couldn't see what was right in front of them. And I suggest one other thing, which is that these perceptions were originated, not so much the one about regulation, but maybe that one too, but the thing about why not idle the truck? You know, who cares?
Oh, yeah.
They originated in a time when there were no limits.
Perceived.
Gas was
plenty.
Cheap.
Yeah.
Land was open. You know, all these things. And they never changed.
Yeah, why?
They were rooted in a kind of a luxury that America had for 100 years.
But also, you know, Walmart took great pride throughout its history of being more efficient and more.
Right.
And so they thought they had their bases covered on this. But again, they weren't really asking the kinds of questions that sustainability requires.
Yeah. I think that that's an interesting point, is that their pride in being the most efficient corporation in the world, this taps into them in a way it might not someone else.
And there's another aspect to it, too, because if you look at companies that have pioneered the kinds of things that Walmart is doing now, that have been doing it for years, like the Patagonia company or Seventh Generation, these sort of niche businesses that make greener products that people are willing to pay more for.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's a perception if you go green, it's going to raise your costs. And there's a certain number of people who are willing to do that, but not Walmart customers. That's not why people come to Walmart. They're coming to get the most they can for as little money as possible. And so those kinds of questions didn't make sense to Walmart to ask about, because they didn't realize that sustainability, this idea that they were now seeing differently, is a race to the top rather than, you know, the race to the bottom that you were talking about before, because the more you do, the more you make back on the investment.
Yeah. Now, it turns out and I don't think I'll jump into that right now, because I think I want to go a little more into how it happened there. But before we finish, we'll talk about, you know, the incompletions or the nagging questions or something. But one of them is that when you say you're going to be sustainable, the easiest stuff is to cut waste.
Yes.
That's the one that's clear. If it weren't good for the environment, you do it anyway, because once you realize it's there, you save money. It seems to me some of the other things, like the switch from to organic apparel, organic cotton. I think you point out that Walmart is now the world's largest dealer in organic cotton,
you know,
or purchaser.
And I guess reseller too.
And as you said, they were so big that they actually became the middleman and started buying the organic cotton from Turkey and elsewhere and even selling it. Some
right.
They weren't even making stuff from, just because they created sort of the big market for it. On something like that or some of the others that no longer, it seems to me, have the immediate bang for the buck, how does that fit the Walmart everyday low prices?
Well, I think what they're doing, they call it democratizing sustainability, because when they enter a market like organics, they do bring the prices down. I mean, you can get fair trade organic coffee at Sam's Club, you know, their club, for astonishingly low prices. And because they have the ability to do that, the ability to deal directly with farming cooperatives in South America to get coffee, or Turkey to get cotton. And that's what they did. They wanted to ramp. They needed more organic cotton products because farmers wouldn't convert because it was too expensive and too risky to do. So they basically underwrote that, and they guaranteed a price and a market for not only the organic cotton, but the it takes 3 years to make that transformation. So they bought up the transitional cotton between conventional or organic. And there was this river trip component to this too.
Okay, because, yeah, let me
cool.
First, we're right at the halfway point. I'm going to tell people again what they're listening to, and then we'll go to the inner workings, because a couple of early wins don't turn this kind of a company around. So we'll talk about that. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize winner Ed Humes about his new book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. And you can learn more by going to edwardhumes.com And Humes is H-U-M-E-S, so it's edwardhumesoneword.com.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my June 2011 conversation with Ed Humes about how focusing on the bottom line led global retailer Walmart to adopt hugely impactful sustainability practices.
Back we go. So, we've taken this and story, and this one really is a story, and I thank you for that. This is not numbers. This is a story about characters. So Jip Ellison has made his inroads. He's gotten his meeting with Lee Scott. Lee Scott has seen, and others at the top, have seen a few early successes. Then, we've got this huge – I didn't realize this. A Walmart carries 60,000 different products in a supercenter. I mean, this is
Maybe more, I think, actually.
I mean, the comparison at Costco carries 4,000. So, I mean, it's like, whoa, that scale. And the largest corporation in the world, it's going to take more than a few early wins. What happens next?
Well, a couple things. We were talking about cotton before the break, and Jib was sending Walmart people out into the world to see the impact of big business on the environment. And their organic cotton push started because a main buyer for their apparel visited Turkey at Jib's suggestion and saw an organic cotton operation, which was like a walk in the park. It was just beautiful. And then same road nearby, a conventional cotton operation where the miasma of toxins in the air just was – your lungs burned, your eyes watered. She saw children playing in this horrible, barren, chemically impregnated zone, and she was just shaken. And you know, we think of a company like Walmart as this faceless corporation, but in fact, there's people working there, and you see something like that, it changes you, and changed her.
And what you realize when you read that, because there's a number of these where you send people off to learn these things, is just that not just Walmart executives, but most executives never see end of the supply trail or the beginning of the supply trail, if you were.
Yeah, and that sort of experience sending the man who's now CEO of Walmart, Mike Duke, to a nice hotel in Sweden, I believe, and talking to a glacier expert about how the glaciers were retreating and sort of seeing the visible trail of global warming. And this guy's trained as an engineer, and he's not a climate skeptic, but he wasn't really someone who gave it a lot of thought. And what do I have to do with it? Or what could I do about it? And these kinds of experiences helped drive this sustainability train and make it personal, you know. And you know, Jib is a master at this. He gets people out in nature and he says, so what are you going to tell your kids or your grandkids about what you did about these challenges, you know, 20 years from now? What are you – and
right,
if you don't think that gets to people, it does.
What's interesting is you ask that question abstractly in Bentonville. You know, what are you going to tell your grandchildren about what you did during the era of climate change or population growth or something? That's one thing. But you do it after you put them in the experience. The question is a whole different question.
Yeah. And you know, you say, go talk to your kids, see what they think. And boy, they heard what they thought. There's things they had never heard before because they never asked. So there was that part of it. And then there was a year into this effort, right at the point where – Lee Scott, the CEO of Walmart, who hired him, said, they had to decide, are we going to go forward with this? Are we going to say, yes, sustainability is a core part of our business or not?
Right. In other words, this lab experiment has shown some promise, but are we really going to shift
gears? Are we going to go all in?
Yeah.
And the Hurricane Katrina struck. And your listeners may remember Walmart actually got quite a bit of credit for their philanthropy at that point, their aid. They gave food and water and medicine to people in Louisiana and Mississippi who were left homeless and destitute as a result of Hurricane Katrina, and did a lot of good work. And a lot of it happened from the grassroots up rather than ordered from top. I mean, store managers getting backhoes and, you know, bursting through into blocked stores and just giving stuff out in the parking lot and saying, well, I don't know if I'm going to get fired or what for this, but we got to do something.
Right,
and they were supported. The company supported that and did more as a result.
And the other thing is that in an instance like that, some of the qualities, the advantages of Walmart, efficiency, being everywhere, being able to move quickly, having huge supplies allowed them to help faster than Mike Brown and FEMA.
Yeah, well, sadly, FEMA had been gutted at that point. That's a whole other story.
Right.
It might have been different a few years before.
Yes.
But Walmart, to its credit, did a lot of good and got credit for it. And so now you have this company that a year before was worried that they were so badly perceived that they were losing business. Now its brand image was sky high. They, you know, every media organization on the planet covered this story
and
their work.
You point out that that makes an interesting choice for the CEO. In other words, on the one hand, he's seen that when you do good, it matters.
Right.
On the other hand, if we've done enough good, maybe we don't have to do this other thing.
Yeah, or we certainly don't need to do much more of it, and we could just, you know.
So that's an important point.
So as this decision about what to do next approaches, Lee Scott gives this speech, and it's ostensibly to Walmart employees, and it's, you know, globally simulcast,
it's the most distributed speech a CEO of Walmart's ever given.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly so. And but it was actually a very public statement about what Walmart would do in the future in terms of environmental practices. And Lee Scott said an interesting thing. He said, you know, Hurricane Katrina, I felt really good about the company and how we were being good and getting credit for it. And we're not used to that. And they're a little sensitive about that, more than a little. And then he said, and we've come to see that the environment is like Hurricane Katrina in slow motion, and that Walmart is a part of that problem and we need to be part of the solution. And he then went on to just shocked the heck out of everybody, most of all his own employees, I think, by announcing these very aspirational goals that were so far ahead of where Walmart is or was, that they seemed almost like crazy talk. You know, well, our ultimate goal someday, don't know when, we're going to be 100% renewable and 100% waste free. And in the short term, we have some very specific goals about lowering our footprint, and he laid those out. And nobody was sure what to make of this.
Well, in fact, one thing you point out is that the critics, when the goals were so pie in the sky, said, see, I mean, that just
proves. It's greenwash. It's happy talk.
Right, right. The other thing that he said in that speech that really struck me, and it's because in the book you don't start the book in 2004. You kind of tell us the history of Walmart, and he goes back to Sam Walton as a reference when he's making this speech about sustainability, which would have been kind of the farthest thing from Sam's mind. Do you want to talk about that? Because I thought that was very
well. He had to get buy-in for him.
Yeah.
Shareholders from a very red state company that, you know, had never really shown much interest in any significant environmental work. It wasn't in his wheelhouse. And this whole sustainability thing could have easily sounded like some radical notion that had no place in a company like Walmart. And he very cleverly took these principles that Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, had laid out about being efficient and about lowering costs and about innovation, and said, this is just another face of what Mr. Sam taught us to do, and we finally come to understand that we can satisfy his vision by through this new area of sustainability.
And there's even one other thing as I read it, which is that he says. He really turns it on its head by saying, when Sam said he could do discount stores in rural areas, people told him it couldn't be done.
Right.
In other words, he basically says, if Sam had listened to conventional wisdom, we wouldn't be here.
Right, right, right.
So for us to do sustainability maybe sound as outrageous, but we're in Sam's tradition.
People say you can't – if you try to be too green, you'll lose money. And we're going to show that we can be sustainable and make a buckload of money while we're doing it. And, of course, that's the music to the ears of a Walmart person. And so that was the pitch. And it was ingenious, really, to sort of capture this figure of Sam Walton and put him on the side of sustainability because that carries a lot of weight in the Walmart. There is a whole culture to Walmart.
Right.
And that was an important and clever move.
Right. That's the voice of Ed Humes. We're talking about his book, Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. You can learn more at edwardhumes.com. I want to spend a little time at the end looking at, you know, where they've fallen short, what the challenges remain, and so on. So just give me a few more either moments or you know, big moves that happened between. We've talked about the early stages.
Well, you know, and this is actually why I wanted to write this book and why I think this is revolutionary, because it's, you know, Walmart had its catalyst to do this. It was the River Guide. Well, Walmart, what's revolutionary about it is they have become a catalyst for other businesses and industries in a very big way, because they quickly realized that, yeah, we can make our stores more energy efficient, and they did. And they can make their truck fleet more efficient. But our real footprint is the products we sell. So 90% of their footprint in the world comes from their suppliers, people who are making things for Walmart to sell. So what do they say? They say, suppliers, we want you to reduce your greenhouse gas emissions 20%. We want you to do X, Y, and Z. And most importantly, and they're engaged in this now, is we want to measure the sustainability of what we sell, which means we want you to measure the sustainability of what you make. Where does it come from? How much water? How much energy? How much carbon? That is an epic task. How toxic is it? What does it do to the landscape? They have a whole list of questions. They have, and no company, no matter how huge, could do it. The government certainly hasn't ever done anything like this. It's like the Manhattan Project of consumption. And they have wangled companies that supply to them, big ones like Procter & Gamble, little guys who swore they'd never work with Walmart, like Patagonia, now is working with them on this. Academic institutions, Harvard, ASU, all these universities, and even their competitors have formed this consortium. Best Buy, Safeway, big chains who compete with them in different places, and environmental groups too.
Because the competitors realize that information is information.
They're calling it pre-competitive collaboration. But the idea is, and Nike's, which has done a lot of work on the toxicity of products and apparel, sharing their data, they're putting together this information on product categories that they can all use communally. And the only way you can do this is if you have everybody participating, or at least a significant chunk of the consumer product puzzle. And they are first using this information to make sourcing decisions about what products to get and which are better. The idea is that if it's the product is made more sustainable, uses less energy, uses less water, it's going to be cheaper. So there's always that. It's never about philanthropy for all, which is a good thing. Because if we want buy-in in the world of business, it has to make sense for a business to do it. So that's their approach. And ultimately, consumers are supposedly going to be able to access this information for making their product choices. But it doesn't depend on that.
Right. So it comes a little bit like where we now see nutrition information at fast food places.
Yeah, but much more
information. Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's information helps you make choices in this time when the biggest plus of the internet, shall we say, is that we now have access to so much information as a buyer, right, as a consumer. One thing that came up again in that, and I've sort of circled around it before, it seems to me that some of these things do not immediately end up in savings. That research, to some extent maybe, but as I said, to switch to less toxic, and a lot of listeners know this notion of externalities, that one way that companies a way of doing business is, and a source of a lot of their profits, is if you can externalize the costs. In other words, if you pollute and you don't have to pay for the pollution, the government pays, or the city pays, or people get sick, they pay, or their insurance company. It doesn't ever – so wherever you can take a cost of doing business and not pay that cost, that helps your bottom line. Some of these things that it looks like Walmart is doing, they had externalized that cost, so it wasn't on their books at all. It's not like fuel or packaging. I think when you point out why they do that, that's still not philanthropy, which you've said a couple of times, is that this notion that – mother shops at Walmart, her daughter shops at Target.
Right. Yes. There is another reason why Walmart thinks this is an important thing to engage in. And it is that, exactly that. Where are these teenagers going to shop when they are the heads of households? No dominant retailing operation has ever carried over that dominance to the next generation. You think about Sears, you think about AMP, you think about all these Woolworths, you name it. They had their moment in the sun, and sometimes it was a decades-long moment, but when the next generation takes over, they go elsewhere. You know, the others will, you know, their Sears is still around, but they aren't what they used to be. And that Walmart doesn't want to follow that historical pattern. And the feeling is that their next generation of customers might be motivated in a way the current generation isn't, to buy things that are greener, that are more sustainable. And they are going to be hungry for that information. And so you can't wait until that moment comes. You need to invest now. And the way they're doing it isn't costing them. They're finding ways to make products at least marginally better, and sometimes much more than marginally better, without it costing any extra, and sometimes costing less. They've brought down the price of CFLs, of compact fluorescent bulbs. They've sold a half a billion of those now, which is four for every household in America. Nobody has sold more than those, and they are an unqualified environmental good. I mean, they're not perfect, but if you compare the small amount of mercury they have in them to what is avoided from power plants. And what did Walmart do? How did they sell these things? They display it prominently. They put up signs saying one of these bulbs will save you $40 over its lifetime.
Which to their clientele.
And they bring the price down with volume.
So one thing I've argued for many times is government procurement as a way to lower prices of things. If the government says we're only going to use hybrid vehicles, the cost of hybrid vehicles will go down. Walmart is probably second to the government
they
in terms of the power of volume.
Yeah. Well, and actually, that's it. You know, I have a story coming out in Sierra Magazine in a couple, you know, a week about the military playing that role that you're talking about, which is very similar. You know, there was a joke going around this green conference I was just at that it used to be the EPA was the most feared acronym if you were worried about a businessman worried about environmental regulation. And now the most feared acronym is WMT, the Walmart stock symbol. And it wasn't really a complete joke. It was they have taken on almost quasi-regulatory aspect in their activities by mandating suppliers become more sustainable.
Now, let me ask you about that, because one of the things that we know that Walmart has always done is they've mandated to their suppliers.
Yeah.
Usually it's been you will deliver it cheaper.
Right.
And if you want our buy, you will deliver it cheaper.
And they still do that.
That's another way of externalizing in a way, isn't it? It's like you don't externalize it economically, but if you make the vendor – give you more for less, and so.
You can just not do business with them. I mean, it's not compulsion.
That's right. And it's that if you want Walmart, you do it Walmart's way. How does this work for the supply chain? In other words, as you say, a Procter and Gamble. I think you know. Okay, they're huge themselves. Is there a reaction from suppliers that this is Walmart just squeezing us another way?
That was the initial reaction, and I'm sure that feeling is still there. But a lot of the returns on sustainability scale up and down. I mean, you don't have to be Walmart for using less energy to make economic sense. And, you know, they've sent these energy audit teams into factories of suppliers that are, you know, small companies. They buy a lot of stuff from relatively small and medium-sized companies. Say, look, do what we did. Plant some trees near your buildings. You know, use energy-efficient lighting. It will pay for itself.
Skylights.
So you have companies that their electric bills that are making for making things go 50-60% down. I mean, this isn't so bad after all.
Right.
They're doing that in China. That with NRD, National Resources Defense Council, with Environmental Defense Fund, they're going into Chinese factories. They've done, I think, 119 big factory operations that supply their stuff and are knocking 20-30% off their energy use and carbon emissions. There's a direct correlation between the two, obviously.
Okay, now let's look a little bit at the dark side. One, I mean, you say outsourced global companies like Walmart can never be completely green or sustainable.
Never. No,
because of course
not.
The model. Right.
Entire U.S. economy is based. What did George Bush tell us to do after 9/11? Go out and buy stuff.
So it's all based on a lot of transportation, and a lot of consumption. And as you point out, which I'm sure people have realized, when the price for a product goes down, you don't get it fixed. So right. part of this thing that gave us $39 DVDs, DVD players, that's right, they're almost as cheap as a new DVD, is it will break quicker and you won't bother to get it fixed because it's too cheap.
You probably couldn't get
bother.
It fixed anyway. Yeah. Who's going to fix it for you?
Yeah. Now, what about the way they treat workers? It seems to me that to be truly sustainable is not just about the environment. It's about people. And there was an article, Walmart's Shocking Impact on the Lives of Hundreds of Millions of People by David Moberg. He writes for In These Times. He writes for American Prospect. I found this reprinted on Alternet within the last month. And the preponderance of research. The net effect of Walmart entering a local market is to reduce local employment, reduce area wage rates and total payroll, eliminate other businesses, especially small shops and small chain stores that compete with Walmart, and raise poverty rates. And there's this other wild statistic. In 2004, the Democratic staff of the House Education and Workforce Committee calculated that a 200-employee Walmart store cost federal taxpayers $420,000 a year, more than $2,000 per employee, because of all the health care, et cetera, that has to be picked up by the government yeah. because they don't make a living wage and they don't get benefits. Are they moving on that? Do they see that linked? Or is that where they've got to stay tight so that they can keep their everyday low prices? What's going on?
Well, they have a ways to go in there. I mean, they're fighting it out in the Supreme Court right now over their gender hiring
right.
practices.
That women were paid less and advanced more slowly.
I think they could make a case that they have improved that behavior if for no other reason the pressure that this litigation that doesn't invalidate the facts that have come out about their past behavior. In terms of the welfare costs, I think they've made some marginal improvements in their medical coverage. But, you know, I mean, there is a lot of valid criticism out there. Of Walmart. I think what
did you get conversations with Lee Scott or someone at that level where you asked this kind of question?
Well, what they say is that they are starting to look at sustainability in a broader way, and that they assert that it is influencing all sorts of business decisions that they're making. Recently, they've partnered with Michelle Obama's group.
On the obesity question.
Yes, they're trying to make processed food at least marginally less salty and fatty and maybe more important, make the healthier foods cost
less.
The same or less as the unhealthiest foods.
And
because why
them,
should you have to pay more
right.
to be healthier?
And feature them the way they feature
And they
green
call that part of sustainability. And you know, they're sourcing more local produce and dealing directly with farmers and providing support to local communities in that way. It's still not keeping the money in the community the way a farmer's market would, but it's better than where they were before. So they're making some progress on there. But, you know, I think sustainability is the one area where they're getting things right.
But by defining it as environmentally.
Whereas
we know what sustainable communities means more than that. We're going to have to leave that conversation and those questions in the air. I'm Terrence McNally, and I've been speaking with Ed Humes. The book is Force of Nature, The Unlikely Story of Walmart's Green Revolution. I highly recommend it, actually. I think it has a lot to say about the way companies work and the way sustainability works. The website is edwardhumes.com. That's H-U-M-E-S. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. And for that, go to terrencemcnally.net. If you want to get my weekly announcement, go to temcnally@mac.com. temcnally@mac.com. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
Tom Hartman here on the best of the rest of economic and labor news. You need to know this. It's only the second full week of the new year, but many corporate CEOs have already made more money than most of us will make for the rest of the year. Despite these exorbitant salaries, many of these same CEOs are fighting hard to keep their taxes low and keep our fellow Americans from making a living wage. According to the Washington Post, by 8:30 a.m. on January 1st, 2013, the CEO of Walmart had already made as much as his typical employee did in a year. And considering that CEO pay has been rising, it's likely that it took even less time to reach that amount in the 2016 new year. With all that cash floating around, it's hard to believe that most Americans have seen their incomes flatline over the last few years and that our middle class continues to fall behind. But when all the income goes to one group and that group refuses to pay their fair share of taxes, that leads to income inequality that's destroying our middle class. According to a recent report from the Pew Research Center, the American middle class has shrunk by more than 10% since 1971, and the gap between rich and poor continues to get wider. In 1965, CEOs made an average of 20 times the salary of their average worker, but today, many top executives bring home more than 300 times as much as they pay their typical employee. That's why our middle class keeps shrinking, and why average Americans feel like it's impossible to get ahead. And that's exactly why we have to change our broken system. We need to continue the fight for a living wage and force those at the top to pay their fair share of taxes. We need to strengthen our unions and rein in the salaries and bonuses of corporate executives who commit crimes or send jobs overseas. We need to invest in putting Americans back to work and reboot the American dream. And all of that starts when we stand together and elect those who will stand with us. This election year, let's prove that when we fight, we win. Just like democracy, equality is a participatory sport. Tag, you're it. Last March, then-Attorney General Eric Holder announced a plan to rein in the federal government's asset forfeiture program, but his efforts didn't go anywhere near far enough. Thankfully, the Department of Justice is taking up the issue where he left off. Although Holder effectively shut down the so-called equitable sharing program, he left open certain exceptions. And unsurprisingly, law enforcement agencies use those exceptions to keep right on taking people's property, regardless of whether or not those assets were illegally obtained. So back in December, a DOJ representative sent a letter to state and local agencies explaining that the forfeiture program is now insolvent and the agency will no longer help law enforcement share confiscated assets. Unfortunately, this change does not stop local officials from simply keeping the assets they collect or the federal government from doing the same. But we can keep pushing until those changes are made as well. No law enforcement agency should take someone's property without a court order. Anything less is a clear violation of our constitutional rights. As of 2014, there were twice as many women in corporate boardrooms in the United States as there were in 1997. But gender equality in boardrooms is still a long, long way off. According to a recent article over at the Think Progress blog, if that rate of change continues at the current pace, it will be another 40 years before women have an equal presence in corporate boards. In interviews with the Government Accountability Office, many people said that they think this problem stems from the fact that board members don't make it a priority to select diverse candidates. Instead, most corporate boards select members from their existing networks. Other countries have fixed this problem by selecting diverse candidates, and their businesses have benefited as a result. Let's push for more boardroom equality here at home. When Colorado voted to legalize cannabis back in 2012, the naysayers predicted that drug addiction and crime would skyrocket in their state. However, those predictions were completely wrong. On January 1st, Colorado celebrated their two-year legal pot anniversary, and the benefits of that vote are stacking up. Thanks to the new law, criminal charges for cannabis possession and distribution have dropped by more than 80%, which means lower costs for the taxpayers. More importantly, it means that thousands of people won't be haunted for the rest of their lives with a criminal record. In addition to reduced arrests, legalization has brought in an enormous amount of revenue for that state. In 2015 alone, Colorado brought in an estimated $125 million in marijuana tax revenue, which is being reinvested back into the state to improve public schools, youth development programs, and much more. And these benefits don't even begin to touch on the incredible impact legalization has had on residents who use pot for medical purposes. Colorado has proven that legal cannabis is beneficial, and they've debunked the anti-pot myths. Hopefully more states soon will follow. And finally, California politicians could be forced to wear the logos of their corporate donors. That's the gist of a measure being pushed by a wealthy Republican businessman in the Golden State. John Cox has submitted a proposed ballot measure to that state's attorney general, and he hopes to start gathering signatures to put the proposal before voters in November. If it's approved, the ballot measure would require political candidates and elected legislators to wear the logos of their top 10 largest corporate donors. Although it's a long way from becoming law, this proposal would make it very easy for voters to see who their lawmakers really represent. And it would make politicians think twice before accepting corporate funds. If we want to take back control of our democracy, we're going to have to get creative. This would be a great way to take on corporate power in California and, frankly, every other state. And that's the way it is. For the week of January 11th, 2016, I'm Tom Hartman on the Economic and Labor News.